One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi there, this is Cecilia, content producer at the Webby Awards. Are you making great work on the internet? If so, I want to take this moment to remind you that the final entry deadline for the 27th Annual Webby Awards is coming up on Friday, December 16th. This year, we're expanding our categories across websites and mobile sites, video, advertising, media, and PR, apps, dApps, and software, social, podcasts, games, and new this year, metaverse, immersive, and virtual. Check out all of our categories and enter your best work by the final entry deadline at webbyawards.com.
From the Webby Awards, I'm David Michelle Davies. This is the Webby Podcast.
Be good to one another.
Proud to be for everyone.
Millennials do good shit. Duh.
Wall Street. What fucking thieves?
Hey there, and welcome back. Today's guest is an avid writer about the intersection of tech, culture, and startups. If your interests also fall in this intersection, then chances are you've heard of his popular weekly Substack or subscribed to it. Rex Woodbury is a partner at Index Ventures and the creator of Digital Native. After working at companies like Goldman Sachs, Calm, and Airtable, Rex decided to pursue his true passions of entrepreneurship, emerging technologies, and the internet's role in all of it. Through Digital Native, Rex is covering the rise of tech trends impacting society and how we got here, from the development of niche business models to what Gen Z really values online and more. During our conversation, Rex and I covered his coming out journey and how that inspired him to launch the Worthy app, a mentoring and support program for the LGBTQ+ community. We also covered Gen Z and how their online habits are changing the digital landscape, plus some interesting insights Rex uncovered in Digital Native about consumer trends and some of his work as an investor at Index Ventures. But first, we talked about the early days of his career.
I came out at the end of my sophomore year in college. And before that, everyone's experience differs. I had a pretty active closeted period where I struggled with my sexuality for a long time, with my sexual orientation. And I think for me, you know, I just didn't have that much exposure. This was, you know, I'm aging myself now, but this was back before, thankfully every year there are more and more kind of openly gay individuals in pop culture and media. And there were some that I really looked up to. I remember I was an athlete and I really struggled with my sexual orientation and how to reconcile that with being an athlete and with masculinity. And there were a few out athletes that I was able to look up to, but there wasn't really anyone that I had a direct line of communication to. And so when I came out, it was a difficult process before. Thankfully, my coming out went well and everyone was very accepting. And I kind of realized that it would have been really helpful and probably saved me a couple of years of pain, that whole facade that I'd created, if I had had a mentor. And so I thought about, you know, what are the ways that we can leverage the internet, social network, social media to connect people who might have shared similar experiences? So for me, it might have been talking to an out athlete to help me understand how I could possibly be gay and also be a good male athlete and fit into a team environment and that kind of thing. For other people, it might be growing up in a really religious household and reconciling that with being gay or bi or trans. For other people, it might be, you know, how to come out to your conservative parents, that kind of thing. And so the idea was kind of, it started as a very simple, you know, Google form that people would input a little bit about themselves and their background and what they were struggling with on the mentee side. And then mentors would be able to sign up and say, you know, here's what I think I could help with. And then we would kind of manually match people. And then over time, it got a little more tech forward and sophisticated. But it really originated from my own experience.
It's such an interesting thing to hear because on the one hand, this is like one of the, you know, there's many great parts and terrible parts of the internet. This just general area is one of the very great parts of it. And it is actually, as you know, goes back decades and decades even. If you know, you were lacking sort of some of those examples, but even 10 years or 20 years before, it was starting to play some small role in helping young people who might be LGBTQ find, you know, other people to talk to or communities to discuss it in, you know, sort of in, even in those early days, it was sort of starting to play that role, but still pretty niche. And to hear that that's sort of the how you sort of were inspired is really interesting, because it just goes to show you that as far as it's all come in those years, it's like not far enough yet.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the things that keeps me inspired about technology and the internet. You know, I think media focuses a lot on the negatives, and I think there are a lot of negative externalities from social media and the internet, but there are also some incredible positives. And those kinds of stories of mentors finding mentees, and, you know, I had a very privileged coming out experience. It went quite well. Not everyone is as fortunate. A lot of people can only find community and belonging online. And a lot of people in remote parts of the world, maybe they haven't had exposure to people like them, not just in the LGBTQ world, but at sort of a microcosm of a lot of different communities. And it's kind of a powerful example of, there's one of our entrepreneurs that we're lucky to work with, Jack Conti at Patreon, has this thing he says where you might grow up in a town of 1,000 people, and you're the only one person out of those 1,000 people that is interested in something, and you feel very alone. But if you go online, there are 4.5 billion people online. So that means there are 4.5 million people who share that interest. And I think that's true for any sort of sexual orientation or race or identity or any sort of facet of who you are as a being. You can probably find someone online that is like you and that you can find that camaraderie and community with. And that's kind of one of the beautiful parts of the internet and one of the reasons that I love online worlds.
Tell me a little bit about how the app is progressed now and what you're doing and where you see it going.
Yeah. So right now it's run by a man named Michael Edmondson. Now he's running with it and there's a board of advisors growing it. And essentially the goal is to be a lot more scalable. And so how can we make it sort of more self-serve where mentors and mentees can connect and interact with their sessions on the app, you know, review their experience, how we can improve it. The goal is just, instead of being a matching form, how can we evolve it into sort of a robust community and serve more experiences. And most of it probably right now is for coming out experiences and people in the early stages of wanting that kind of mentorship. But we've observed this interesting phenomenon where I think, usually when people come out, they realize that they could be a mentor to someone through that coming out experience. But at the same time, I think a lot of our mentors could also still be mentees to someone. I know that I, even though I've been out for, I guess, about 10 years now, certainly could use some mentorship from openly gay people who have been through different work experiences or different parts of life that I've yet to enter. Maybe it's going through surrogacy and having kids or adoption. And so we're trying to turn that flywheel into each, you know, almost unit of supply can also be a unit of demand and vice versa on the platform, where that's the thing about mentorship and menteeship is that everyone is usually able to be both. And how do we encourage that process?
You know, some of this was informed by, it sounds like, some of your experience on social media as well. And I think at the outset, would you say that you were able to drive awareness to Worthy through social media?
Yeah, I think probably 90% or more of Worthy's growth back in the day, in the early days, was through Instagram. And, you know, it's been an interesting case study for me and the power, again, of social media, which, you know, I have a tenuous relationship with at times, like many of us. And I think we all wonder whether it's been a net positive or net negative for us as individuals and for society. But, you know, without it, I think Worthy certainly couldn't have gotten off the ground in a lot of other communities as well. So that's what keeps me kind of looking on the glass half full side of social media.
So tell me a little bit about your personal experience with social media. I know it had changed at some point. I know you've gone through some different evolutions of the way you look at it, taking some breaks, and sort of what you've learned from that and how it influences your work now and certainly some of your investing, I'm sure, as well.
I would say I'm a member of the generation that was not quite digital natives, but more kind of digital early adopters, where You know, I had MySpace and AOL Instant Messenger early on. And then when my very kind of formative years of middle school and high school and college was sort of the peak of Instagram and almost what I call performative social media. And so this was where, you know, Instagram originated as truly a filtered version of reality, right? The killer feature initially was photo filters. And then of course, apps like Facetune and Lightroom and these other editing apps sort of began to warp our senses of reality. And I think I certainly felt pressure to seem perfect online and in your sort of perfect Instagram grid. And I think we've moved away from that. And I think Gen Z is leading the charge as well in more kind of authentic ways of communicating online. But for a lot of my time growing up, I mean, I really struggled with that of seeking validation and airbrushed, you know, curated photos online and that perfect sense of expression of who you are. And so for me, I took a break a couple of years back. I think I took a year off most social media and kind of realized that measuring your life and your self-worth in metrics like likes and followers, those aren't the right metrics by which to measure a life and to measure happiness. And so that was my journey. And I think now realizing to lean into different platforms that I'm proud to express things differently. So less visual platforms like Instagram and more so kind of writing on Substack, Twitter at times, reframing the kinds of content that I'm putting out there. But it has informed a lot of how I think about, from an investor perspective, the next generation social companies and the evolution that we're going to see with social media.
Well, if there was one or a few, or what were the experiences that sort of led you to reflect on the way the performative nature of Instagram, say, was impacting you? Like, how did you come to sort of having that realization and then deciding to take a break from it all?
Yeah, this was probably 2017 or 2018. I always call it kind of the Museum of Ice Cream era of Instagram, where it was sort of hyper filtered and curated, and we all were, you know, going to these pop-up museums to get the perfect photo and you know, the latte art and murals and the Kylie Jenner era. And I think I just kind of realized one day that I was measuring how happy I was by the number of likes or followers that I was receiving online, and that I was a lot happier on platforms like Snap, which are much more messaging focused, or TikTok, which are much more kind of similar to YouTube, like television, versus those kind of ways to show off for your peers. And so I sort of made a conscious effort to spend my time either in close, intimate circles with friends on messaging apps, or being more of a participant in a parasocial environment like a TikTok or YouTube, where I enjoy the content, find it interesting, find it entertaining, and quite educational at times, and not necessarily spending a lot of time in that messy middle. And that's how I think about social today. When I think about from an investor perspective, I tend to think about social as this set of concentric circles, where you can think about them as sort of the evolution of the different relationships you have, or the different sets of contacts that you have in your life, with the innermost concentric circle being your closest family and friends, and the outermost circle being strangers around the world. And then sort of the inner rings 2 and 3 are your friends and acquaintances. And the original set of social media that we've mostly been talking about was built on those in-between rings, which was, you know, me connecting on Facebook with my high school roommate, you know, me following all of my college classmates on Instagram. And I think those are the relationships that really lean into the performative aspect of social media, because in the closest of the inner circle, you get to be a lot more authentic in who you are. And then ironically, when you're kind of posting for strangers, as you are on TikTok or YouTube, sometimes people are much less wary of how they're coming across, because they don't know the people. And so they're more willing to be creative and expressive in different ways. And so, you know, my own kind of personal journey was moving away from those no man's land in between platforms. And, you know, interestingly, that's kind of how the last couple of years of evolution have gone as well, with a lot of people turning to more messaging focused products, or to more kind of one to many.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Content platforms.
So you brought up the concept of parasocial. Just for listeners who maybe haven't sort of run by that term, can you share a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it's sort of this one-to-many relationship. So if you think of a YouTube creator, that creator has this parasocial relationship with his or her community, with subscribers. And same on TikTok. It's a really interesting phenomenon because when we think of the creator economy or these different phrases, it's really this idea of one person having this relationship with a lot of people that they might not know, but those people are quite intimately familiar with the creator. A lot of the rings two and three, those in-betweens, Instagram and Facebook were built on, are much more sort of two-sided streets where I follow you, you follow me, we know each other offline. It's your sort of geographic relationships that are then ported online. And now there are a lot of these digitally native relationships that are one-to-many and are really built around user-generated content, but parasocial relationships with content creators who then have communities.
In some way, those type of relationships are new in that they're sort of social media-based now, but they're somewhat similar to like old-school celebrity relationships, right? It's like, you know, people would think maybe they would never be as intimate with an actress as they are with like somebody who's they watched 150 TikTok videos, because just the level of intimacy maybe is not the same, but that there's this feeling that you know the person, but actually they don't really know you at all, because and they've really let you in, but you haven't let them in, obviously, because they're
yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think it's interesting to track over time how those parasocial relationships change based on the form of medium. So for instance, you know, to your point, certainly the 20th century was dominated by film and film actors. But if you think about, you know, your Marilyn Monroe's or Cary Grant's of the world, you maybe interacted with them once or twice a year when they had a film come out. When you did, they were 20 feet tall on a big screen. And so they were literally larger than life. And then when you saw them outside of that, there wasn't social media. And so you saw them on a red carpet, and it was a much more sort of less familiar relationship. And then television, you know, it brought that relationship into your living room. If you think of Oprah, you know, all of a sudden you felt this closeness because there she was and you were seeing her every day. The frequency increased, the screen was smaller. All of a sudden there's a little more of that authentic connection. And then, you know, smartphones and mobile and video and all of this acceleration, this Cambrian explosion and creativity that we've seen the last few years has made it so that, you know, celebrities are much more niche. I don't think we'll ever have a celebrity as big as Marilyn Monroe or Oprah again, because everyone has that niche on their For You page on TikTok or the YouTube channels that they subscribe to.
You're also an investor, a partner at Index Ventures. What are some of the areas that you focus on investing in, and how does some of this, what we discussed around social, how does that inform it?
Yeah, I'm broadly focused on, I like to say, sort of the intersection of people and technology. So the things that interest me are consumer behavior, how people interact with one another, with content. So that's often social companies. It's a lot of marketplaces. It's a lot of commerce and how commerce is being digitized. And, you know, these are all topics that we talk a lot about at Index. You know, relevant to this conversation is we're investors in Discord. We like to say, I like to point to Discord's 19 million active servers every week that they have as a metaphor for the different niches of the internet and how online no interest is really too niche. And so, you know, these are topics that interest us, the shift of social to messaging, to content platforms, as well as just broadly how people are embracing new kinds of digital tools to create things, to share things with each other, and how to transact online.
Is there any companies you've invested with recently that you're particularly excited about?
One that comes to mind is we recently invested in a company called Beam, which is basically enabling commerce companies to donate a portion to nonprofits. And so it's this sort of interaction between shoppers online, the brands that they shop with, and nonprofits. So the way it works is if I went to buy something from a brand, in my shopping cart, it will say, you can donate 1% of your cart to a nonprofit that you like. And so for me, maybe often they're data driven. So it might say a New York-based LGBTQ homeless shelter. And importantly, it's the brand that's paying that 1%. And so as a shopper, I'm very drawn to that because you know, the brand is putting its values first, and it's actually putting its money where its mouth is. And so I like that as a consumer, but for a brand, they actually like it because their average order value, their AOV goes up, cart abandonment rates go down, people are more willing to check out when they see that kind of impact. And then of course, nonprofits are getting real donations and new donors and building that relationship with people. So it's this interesting win-win-win situation. And I think if we study Gen Z behavior, there's this sort of table stakes view that really everyone needs to be impact first in their commerce experience. And so with Beam, and the website is beamimpact.com, brands can sort of just integrate that infrastructure of impactful commerce.
Tell me a little bit more about that. You said that with Gen Z, there's this sort of table stakes idea of impact around everything.
Yeah, when I talk to younger people just to learn about the different behaviors that they have, I'm always struck by how the affinity for mission-driven companies. And so I think a lot of that comes from growing up in this world where a lot of people saw their parents lose their jobs in the Great Recession. A lot of people entered the workforce during the pandemic. They've grown up with climate change. They've grown up with gun violence. There are all of these sort of social causes in the world that people are passionate about. And you know, there's this sort of critical view of capitalism, of wanting our capitalist system to be directed toward productive ways. And that can come in sustainability. It can come in the brands that Gen Z prefers and how they interact. One example I often think of is Nike has consistently been rated as Gen Z's favorite brand. And you can see the Colin Kaepernick ads that they do as an example of putting their values first and foremost. So, you know, typically young people, but also consumers of all ages prefer brands that take a stance and put their money where their mouth is. And it's an interesting shift of how do brands keep up with that and ensure that they're showing and communicating to their consumers who they are.
Yeah, it's tricky, right? Because to do that in an authentic way, every company out there does something wrong. There's no company that does everything right. There's no person that does everything right. So it's hard for companies to figure out how to take a stand and do so in an authentic way while also understanding that there's a bunch of stuff they're probably not doing as well as they could be.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I think about a lot because you're exactly right that it's very important for it to be done in the right way. And that's one of the reasons that Beam's model is elegant, because shoppers, I think, would not be okay with themselves giving 1% of their cart, because they'd say, why am I not the multi-billion-dollar corporation here being the one to pay this? And so it says a lot that the brand is willing to do that. And of course, there are incentives, and it's an elegant structure where everyone sort of benefits from that. But it definitely needs to be done in the right way. And, you know, I'm certainly a capitalist. I believe that capitalism is a very powerful tool for social good when it's directed in the right way. But, you know, I think stakeholder capitalism versus shareholder capitalism is an interesting comparison. And we're seeing this generation grow up with what's been somewhat of a broken model of capitalism that's very based on investor return versus taking care of employees and customers. And I think there's the fundamental rethinking of that with the younger generation. And some of that we see in sort of a skeptical view of capitalism in general. But I think a lot of it will just mean rethinking how we actually build this capitalist system.
You do a lot of work with around creators, and I would therefore suppose around some of the sort of like more tech elements of creator world, such as like NFTs and Web3 and stuff like that. What has it been? What's this last year watching? Which I think that like in, you know, 20, 30 years, we'll look back at like the last couple of years is just like really one of the biggest change moments of around internet culture that, you know, in 50 years, honestly, there's just been so much activity and so much innovation. Similarly to like the 2000s though, lots of really positive things and lots of really negative things and big economic woes because of it. What's your take on what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to look back on these few years as this interesting confluence of a number of trends, both short-term and long-term. I think what we had, of course, the near-term shock of the pandemic, which changed a lot of behaviors and sent the market through an initial shock, and then it resumed its sort of historic bull run. At the same time, we've had the coming of age of a new workforce, Gen Z entering the market, younger people growing up, as well as an aging society and a lot of interesting demographic shifts. And so much has happened that has shifted how we think about technology. To your point around the markets, I mean, you know, mobile and cloud have been the two dominant trends of the last 10 or 12 years. I think there's a lot of anxiety that both are quite saturated. It doesn't mean that there aren't opportunities remaining in the two. But, you know, they certainly aren't as ripe for innovation as they once were. And so we see a lot of interest in crypto and AI and VR and AR. You know, people are looking for what the next big thing is. And at the same time, there's more capital than ever, to your point, chasing those opportunities. You know, you've got massive consumer behavior. You've got a pandemic. You've got a lot of record levels of venture dollars out there. At the same time, it's never been easier to start a startup and lower costs to do so. So there's record business creation. So it's just this really interesting sort of kaleidoscope of a lot of different trends. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see what comes of it. But it's certainly an interesting time to be in the startup world.
You have a Substack called Digital Native. You had an article recently, which I think sort of captures what you're just saying. I just found endlessly fascinating. It was 10 charts that capture how the world is changing. I'll just mention a few of the charts, not all of them you had. You had one on home ownership, which showed that essentially people used to like buy homes or rent homes within a few miles from their office. And all of a sudden in 2021 or two, it's like 50 miles. It's like a 10x change or something like that. There was one around the price changes in consumer goods, super fascinating. All this like disposable stuff like clothing and things like that are actually not,
TVs.
It's not going up, it's going down. But all the stuff that really matters, like healthcare and education, is like becoming drastically more expensive. You had the fastest growing jobs, which is like some of it was so interesting pandemic related stuff like animal trainers, and then really obvious things like healthcare and personal care. And then this sort of other one that was about like how the nature of pop culture and like where pop culture lives and which countries it's coming from is really changing. Altogether, it just paints this like there's no thread that I could find. Is there a thread there that you find uniting? Is there some view that really like makes sense of all of that?
I don't think so. I mean, I think a lot of my pieces will have sort of a interesting through line. And I kind of mentioned this at the top. Usually one piece, I write them every Wednesday. It'll usually be narrow and deep. This piece was a little more shallow and broad. And the goal was to touch on a number of different shifts. And I think what's interesting of the ones you highlighted is it goes back to this point of there being both a lot of short-term shocks and long-term secular trends. So the homeownership, you know, that's directly pandemic related. It's really interesting to think about what that does to, what are the ripple effects of that? Of course, there's remote work, the different jobs that people are drawn to. What does it do to the mountain towns that everyone's moving to? I was just reading an interesting article around Lake Tahoe and how locals are reacting to the influx of Bay Area folks moving there. What are the business opportunities? You know, a lot of people are looking to buy second homes, buy primary homes, you know, invest in homes. And then, of course, like there are second and third order effects. You know, it's interesting to think about with the elections happening a couple weeks ago, what happens to the map of red and blue in the country when people aren't tethered to their city for work, and maybe the urban folks move into more rural areas. So all sorts of interesting things there, but that one's certainly a very direct shock from the last couple of years. Whereas the second one you highlighted was the price changes of services and goods over the last 20 years. And that one, you know, is certainly one of the longest term trends out there. Of, if you look at TV prices over the last 20 years, they're down something like 98%. I can buy a smart TV for a stunningly low price right now, whereas education has tripled and healthcare costs have doubled and college tuition is near unaffordable. And that's just a long-term trend that has real structural issues, mostly in policy. And so it's just interesting to look at the different ones. And I think that's one of the joys of being a venture investor or being in the startup world is, you know, one of the privileges of my job is getting to context switch of learning and thinking through what are the trends. Some might be caused by something short-term, some are long-term, but you know, they're both going to have massive effects over the next 10, 20, 30 years. And so what are the interesting businesses that can be built, and who are the sort of singular entrepreneurs with a vision for how to make that world different?
Yeah. I mean, in times of change, you know, that's where opportunity, I mean, that's what, you know, that's what really successful entrepreneurs will always tell you, is that in change is where opportunity lies. Certainly seems like there's a lot of change. On the politics thing is so fascinating around the home ownership. Is that if it plays out, it'll be really interesting to see if it plays out long enough. Can we get to the question as to like, what are they, do they live in those places because they are those things, or are they those things because they live in those places? Right. Which is sort of I'm sure it's neither one of the, either of them, but it's a mix of that. But that is sort of one of the big implications of that home ownership change, which would be fascinating to see.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many different demographic changes in America, and, you know, I think another chart from that piece was how fast our population is aging. You know, every day 10,000 people turn 65, and the ratio of young to old is changing dramatically. You mentioned healthcare is the fastest growing profession, and that's directly related to the need for home aides to take care of seniors. So there are all sorts of interesting trends, and I think the job of a venture investor is thinking through where are the big businesses that can be built, and just, you know, having the eye for who are the entrepreneurs who are going to go build it.
Rex Woodbury, so great to have you on the Webby podcast. Thank you so much for joining. The Substack is Digital Native. I encourage everyone to check it out. Thank you.
Thank you. No, great to be on, and excited to chat with more people, and appreciate the time.
A huge thank you to Rex Woodbury for stopping by the Webby podcast. Stay caught up with Rex and his latest internet discoveries by subscribing to Digital Native on Substack and following Rex on social media at Rex Woodbury, REXWOODBURY. If you're interested in being part of the online mentoring community, download the Worthy app, available on Android and iOS. For more information about the Webby Awards, please visit us at webbyawards.com or on most social platforms at The Webby Awards. If you like our podcast, we'd be so grateful if you took a moment to give us a rating or review. You can reach me on social at DMDLikes. Our editor is Kate Mishkin. Our editorial lead is Jordana Jarrett. Our writer is Mahi Sugebo. Our producer is Cecilia Betzel. Music is Poddington Bear. CL Vanderveen is our managing director, and Claire Graves is our president. I'm David Michelle Davies, and this is the Webby Podcast.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.